Welcome back to the Deep Dive. We plunge into these incredible texts and hopefully surface with some really compelling insights for you.
Always a pleasure to dive in.
Today we're tackling some fantastic questions you sent about, well, a truly foundational and frankly vivid passage in ancient literature.
It really is.
Yeah, picture this. You're standing under this darkening ancient sky. There's a solemn ritual happening. A really profound promise being forged, but with these surprising, almost chilling details.
You can almost feel it, can't you? That sense of history, but also something immediate. The dust, the twilight. Like, you're right there with Abram. It's packed with mystery and huge implications.
Exactly. So our deep dive today goes straight into Genesis chapter 15, specifically verses 10 through 15.
A short passage, but incredibly dense.
Right. And it's not just some dusty old story. This is a pivotal moment, this covenant ritual, and it really lays the groundwork for so much that comes later.
Absolutely.
So our mission today is to unpack the layers here of the Hebrew text, what this incredible covenant meant for Abram, for his descendants.
And what it might hint at for us, even now, about divine promises.
Definitely. We'll explore how these verses kind of set the stage.
It's a real masterclass in covenant making, you know, a dramatic unveiling of God's plans that just resonates down the centuries.
Okay, let's jump in. The ritual itself. Abram is told to bring specific animals, a three-year-old heifer, goat, ram, and then birds, a turtle dove, and a pigeon.
Mm-hmm. Very specific ages and types.
And then the text gets quite graphic about what he does next, what's actually happening here. Can you walk us through it?
Sure. So Abram takes the larger animals, the heifer, the goat, the ram, and he cuts them in two. He divides them down the middle.
Right down the middle.
Yes. And then he lays each half opposite the other. So he creates this pathway, this kind of, well, a bloody aisle between the carcass halves.
Wow. Okay.
And the Hebrew verb used is bayar. It literally means to cut, to divide.
Bayar. Got it.
And this action is where we get the technical phrase karat barat.
Which means?
To cut a covenant. It's not metaphorical. It stems from this very physical, very real act.
So definitely not just a handshake or signing on the dotted line. This is deeply physical. Almost gruesome, really.
It is. And that's the point.
What's the core message, then, behind cutting a covenant this way?
It's a self-maledictory oath. It's visceral, unforgettable. The person making the promise, often walking between those halves, is implicitly saying, may this happen to me, may I be cut in two like these animals if I break this oath.
Whoa. So the stakes couldn't be higher.
Exactly. It underscores the absolute cost, the binding nature of this kind of covenant. There's no wiggle room. Lives are literally on the line.
That really changes how you think about the word covenant. Now, there's a curious detail right after this.
Yeah.
He cuts the big animals.
Mm-hmm.
But the text makes a point of saying he did not cut the birds.
Mm-hmm.
Why that distinction? Does it matter?
Oh, it absolutely matters. It's one of those details that seems small, but it's actually crucial. And right after Abram arranges everything, verse 11 kicks in.
Okay, what happens?
Birds of prey descend. The Hebrew is hate, often translated as vultures. Mm-hmm. They come down aiming for the carcasses.
Vultures.
Right.
Not exactly a good sign.
No. And what does Abram do? He immediately drives them away, protects the offering.
So he's batting away scavengers. Is there more to it than just keeping things tidy? What might this foreshadow?
Many think this is deeply symbolic, not just a random detail. These hayit, these vultures. They're seen by some commentators as foreshadowing hostile forces, like nations, maybe?
Hostile nations. Trying to
consume the sacrifice, metaphorically speaking. Trying to derail God's promise, to destroy the covenant before it even gets going.
Oh, okay. I see.
And Abram, by driving them away, is already stepping into this role. He's the protector of the covenant, even at this early stage.
So it's like a mini preview of the struggles ahead for his descendants and his role in safeguarding the promise.
Exactly. It's a subtle but powerful glimpse into the opposition that this covenant and the people bound to it will inevitably face.
Fascinating. Okay, so the scene is set. The animals are there. The vultures are driven off. Then, as the sun starts to go down, the whole atmosphere shifts. Verse 12 talks about a deep sleep falling on Abram.
Mm-hmm.
But this isn't just drifting off, is it? The Hebrew word used, tardema, feels important.
It is, very much so. Tardema isn't just being tired. It's used only a handful of times. And crucially, it's the same word used when God caused Adam to fall into that deep sleep before Eve was created.
Right. Okay, so it signals something profound, something divinely induced.
Precisely. It's a stupor, a state beyond normal sleep.
And what's the significance of Abram being in this Tardama state? What does it tell us about who's actually doing the covenant making here?
It highlights Abram's complete passivity at this critical moment. He's not negotiating. He's not participating actively.
He's out.
He's out. God is the sole actor here. God is taking full unilateral responsibility for establishing this covenant and implicitly for fulfilling it. It emphasizes God's sovereignty, God's initiative, God's commitment.
God's doing the heavy lifting, so to speak.
Yeah, entirely. Abram is the recipient, experiencing something incredibly profound, but he's not an active party in the making of it at this point.
And it's not exactly a sweet dream he falls into, is it? The text says, a great and terrifying darkness fell upon him.
Yeah, that phrasing is intense. Oh, marashaka.
Can you break that down? Amashoka, Junjo.
Sure. Amas is dread, a kind of trembling awe, maybe even horror. Egos is thick, oppressive darkness. Kedushos just means great, large. So a great dread and thick darkness.
That does not sound pleasant.
No, it's not meant to be comforting. This isn't a cozy vision. It's described as a cosmic heaviness. Mm. It's the feeling of being in the presence of a holy, awesome God, and it's overwhelming, terrifying even.
So it sets a very solemn, serious tone for what God is about to say.
Absolutely. And importantly, this kind of profound supernatural darkness in the Bible often carries connotations of judgment. It foreshadows something difficult.
So it's a sign of God's immense presence, but also carries this undertone of holiness, seriousness, maybe even impending judgment.
I think that's a good way to put it. It frames the subsequent revelation in a context of ultimate seriousness.
Okay, so out of this deep sleep, this terrifying darkness, God speaks. He gives Abram a prophecy about his descendants. And the way God starts seems really emphatic in Hebrew.
It really is. God says, Yedatoda. It's a doubling of the verb to know.
Yedatoda, meaning?
No, you shall surely know, or know for certain. It removes any doubt. This isn't a maybe. This isn't a possibility. This is a guaranteed future, an emphatic declaration.
Okay, know for certain. And what is it that Abram needs to know for certain? The prophecy itself sounds pretty grim.
It is sobering. God tells him his descendants will be strangers, sojourners in a land that isn't theirs.
Okay.
They will become servants, slaves essentially, and they will be afflicted for 400 years.
Afflicted. What's the Hebrew word there?
The word is nu, from the root dina. It means to oppress, to humble, to mistreat, to put down, to subject to hardship.
400 years of being oppressed, strangers and servants, that's heavy. A really long, painful time.
Incredibly long.
What's so striking about this specific prophecy? How does it connect later on?
Well, this is one of those moments where you see the threads being woven early on. This description, strangers, afflicted, servants, 400 years, it points directly, unmistakably, to the future enslavement of the Israelites in Egypt.
As told in Exodus.
Exactly as told in Exodus. The language, the time frame, it's a clear foreshadowing. It shows how even these incredibly difficult periods, like the Egyptian bondage, were known, foretold, and somehow part of God's larger unfolding plan. These linguistic and thematic seeds are planted right here.
It's amazing how those echoes work. But God doesn't leave it there with just the grim news. Right away, there's a balance of promise of judgment on the oppressors and deliverance.
That's crucial, yes. Immediately after predicting the hardship, God pivots. He declares, "But I myself will judge the nation that they serve."
I myself, what's the Hebrew for that?
Anshi Don. Anshi is the emphatic form of I. Don is judge. So I myself will judge. It puts this intense personal divine emphasis on it. God is saying, don't worry, I'm personally stepping in. I will handle this.
So divine intervention is guaranteed. It's not just abstract justice. It's God taking direct action.
Precisely.
And the result of God's judgment. What happens after the 400 years?
The result is liberation and more. God says, afterward, they shall come out with great possessions.
Great possessions. So not just freedom, but wealth.
Exactly. It's not just about escaping bondage. It's a promise of reparations, almost. Compensation for all those years of suffering and unpaid labor.
And that connects to Exodus, too, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The Israelites leaving Egypt with gold and silver.
Directly. It foreshadows the plundering of the Egyptians described in Exodus 12. It shows God's commitment to justice isn't just about punishment for the oppressors, but also restoration and provision for his covenant people. Even through suffering, he promises vindication and blessing.
Justice, deliverance, and reparations. That's a powerful combination. But then after all this big picture, multi-generational prophecy about his descendants' hardship and eventual triumph, God brings it right back to Abram personally.
He does. It's a remarkably tender moment after such heavy news.
God says, As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be buried in a good old age. Let's talk about that in peace. Bai shalom.
Beihum, yes. This is so much more than just quietness or lack of conflict. It's shalom.
Shalom, which means?
Wholeness, completeness, well-being, flourishing. It's a state of everything being right, aligned, fulfilled according to the covenant promise. It's a really rich, deep concept.
So God is giving Abram this deep personal assurance. You, Abram, despite knowing about the future struggles of your descendants, your own end will be one of wholeness, of shalom.
Exactly. He won't live to see the 400 years of affliction that his seed or offspring will endure. His personal journey concludes in completeness, in a good old age, gathered to his ancestors.
That contrast is really striking, isn't it? The terrifying darkness, the grim prophecy for the future nation, and then this intimate promise of personal peace for Abram himself.
It really is. It shows God's care operating on multiple levels simultaneously. There's the big, overarching, sometimes difficult plan for the descendants, the collective.
Right.
But there's also this specific, tender concern for Abram, the individual. It says a lot about God's character dealing with vast historical sweeps and also intimate personal realities.
It's complex. God's promises aren't always simple or easy, but they encompass both the personal and the collective.
That seems to be the message here.
And looking back at the whole sequence, what really stands out is that dynamic. Abram is passive, asleep in that tardema.
Utterly passive.
While God is the one acting, speaking, promising, taking responsibility, the covenant ritual itself starts with blood, division, the threat implied.
Mm-hmm. And that terrifying darkness, Omahusha, hinting at judgment, foreshadowing suffering.
But it doesn't end there. It's bound up with this unbreakable divine promise, this hope, and it ultimately points towards shalom.
That's the trajectory. Wholeness, completeness, for Abram personally, yes, but also implicitly, eventually, for Israel as a whole, after the period of hardship. This passage, using terms like karat, beret, terdoma, marushuka, and shalom, it just paints this incredible picture.
A journey through darkness and difficulty, but underwritten by God's absolute commitment.
Absolutely. Suffering is foretold, it's part of the story, but deliverance, justice, and ultimate peace, shalom, are God's guaranteed destination for his covenant people.
So reflecting on this deep dive into Genesis 15, it seems to reveal this fundamental idea. Sometimes the biggest, most lasting promises are wrapped up in really profound challenges, in moments of deep solemnity, even terror.
It certainly seems that way here.
It makes you wonder, doesn't it, about our own lives? Are there situations that feel impossible, maybe even terrifying, that might actually be preparing the ground for some kind of ultimate promise, some future wholeness or deliverance we can't yet see?
That's a challenging thought.
Yeah. And what does it mean for us when we hit those moments that seem to demand passive trust, where we can't control the outcome, where maybe all we can do is acknowledge that a deeper plan might be unfolding, a plan that's heading towards an ultimate shalom, even if the path there involves darkness?
Heavy questions, but definitely worth pondering after digging into a text like this.